Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of the GeoMob Podcast. My name is Denise McKenzie, one of the now five podcast hosts of our fantastic GeoMob Podcast. And with me today, I have a great friend, Rhiannon Price, who I've known for well over 10 years now, and a new friend, Bill Greer, whose career I have followed for quite a while now, who are working together on an amazing new initiative called Common Space, which you will also see my name pop up in along as well, because I'll be joining one of the task forces alongside Rhiannon in the next couple of months. But more on that in a little bit. What we'll start with, though, I think, is a little bit of the introduction from both Rhi and from Bill about their careers and a bit on the journey and story as to how they've got to this amazing initiative of Common Space. So, Rhiannon, I'm going to throw to you first to give a little bit of an intro about yourself. But some of the journey. How did you get here to Common Space?
Yeah, well, and first and foremost, thanks for having us on, Denise. We're stoked to be here and stoked to kick off the work together, too, coming up. So my career has been kind of a meandering one, but there's definitely a common thread, I would say, which is really about democratizing technology for very human problems. And so that's been consistent for me even back when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Eastern Caribbean right out of college. We were doing things like participatory mapping or understanding the socioeconomics of a fishing village and the kind of social capital there so that they can be more disaster resilient. And for me at the time, it was so eye-opening to see, one, the community spirit and how much folks owned that data and how then it kind of matriculated into decision-making and was a resource for them, all the way to jump years later to me joining what was at the time Digital Globe, then later Maxar, and seeing these incredible cutting-edge technologies and the power of that and really the immense potential and being able to work with all these brilliant folks who really didn't necessarily think about the humanitarian part of the equation or the sustainable development implications of what we were doing. And so to be able to kind of be that person to straddle these worlds has always been such a privilege for me and one I certainly don't take lightly, but being able to bring kind of these disparate stakeholders together and figure out how can we better unlock the value of what we have is pretty exciting and something I've done even, you know, before Common Space. And Bill and I, of course, met at Maxar. I'll let him do his intro too, but joined, you know, from different parts of the business by the same idea of what can we do more, because this technology needs to benefit people more than it does currently.
Absolutely. Well, and I can 100% attest to meeting Rhi right when she was in the middle of doing this humanitarian work as well, because I have a feeling it was Dar es Salaam, actually, in Tanzania, doing the Romani Huria project. So yeah, that was definitely a piece of work there. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rhi. Bill, I'd love to hear your kind of journey here and also, I guess, how you bumped into Rhiannon and got here to Common Space as well.
Yeah, for sure. So I got my start in the geospatial world back in, I think it was like 2006 or 2007. I actually moved to Washington, D.C. to row boats with Sean Gorman. And so we were both trying to make the national team for rowing. And so I kind of got pulled into kind of before it was GeoCommons stuff, which was a really early kind of Web 2.0 open data sharing platform trying to get kind of everyone into mapping and geospatial technology. So think of like early ArcGIS Online style things, but making data open. And for me, that was really transformational because that was right around when the Haiti earthquake happened and the Afghan elections in 2009. And so we were trying to get data open for these kind of disasters and situations. That ended up getting acquired by Esri back in, I want to say, 2012, where same team kind of got together and made the ArcGIS Hub to make data more open and accessible, and a little bit less volunteer-driven, a little bit more like, you know, authentic data from organizations. We then moved to a startup called Timber.io, which was acquired by Maxar. So that was Timber was more about making open methodologies available. Specifically, I think we all know that geospatial and specifically remote sensing data is really hard to work with. So we came out with kind of a Jupyter notebook-based system that made it easier to do a bunch of analysis on satellite imagery. So again, trying to make the data more accessible, more open, and having an eye on where that's really, really useful. So we turned into the GBDX team at Digital Globe, which was started by the Tomnod guys. We kind of joined in to try to make GBDX notebooks a thing. And so that's kind of where I ran into Rhiannon. Pierre Azard was actually like, once I got there, he's like, you need to meet Rhiannon. And I think I just barged into, which he was on a meeting on a call. And I was just like, hey, I'm just here to listen and learn. And I've heard you're amazing. And everyone says you're great. So
Bill, it was a Twitter chat. We were like live doing this online Twitter chat around, funny enough, disaster resilience at the time, with like we had Humanitarian OpenStreetMap online, NetHope online, us kind of curating these questions. And I remember this guy just walking in and saying, I'm supposed to meet you. And meanwhile, I'm like, I am kind of in the middle of something here, but it's lovely to meet you. Have a seat. You know, you want to hop on Twitter and chime in? Go for it. And here we are today.
Yeah. Taking note, I'm the extrovert of the common space group. My job is to jump into the rooms and expose the ideas. So Digital Globe, that's where I met Rhiannon. And we worked together for years. She tried to send me to Afghanistan. then COVID hit. So I ended up leaving Maxar to go to a startup called Albedo, which was a super early employee there, where I got to see the actual, building and planning of a satellite constellation. So that's kind of to round it off. I've been really lucky in my career to kind of see both the hardware early design phases, and then at Maxar, I saw the product processing, the analysis, the GIS, and then I've also been on the ground in some humanitarian scenarios. So I feel like that through line really shows the value of, A, you need to understand a lot of things in the system. They're all getting better and easier over time, but it still takes someone to bring it all together. So that's, I think, what I'm really excited about at Common Space is just being that fundamental core source of imagery that all of these things will branch down from to actually make a difference. Because I think that's where the bottleneck is. And if you're trying to fix things not where the bottleneck is, then you're not really fixing it. So
I think I'd have to agree about that. And I've got to say there, Bill, that getting into geospatial via rowing has to be a first. I have not heard that one as the entry point before. So that's a fascinating one.
We actually pulled a bunch of other people, like GeoCommons. We were just recruiting from the boathouse, honestly. I think we had four different Olympic rowers come through.
Who knew that rowing clubs was the way to recruit people into geospatial? Maybe we all need to be considering this. This is clearly something we've missed before as a sector.
I have a theory that rowers are used to working really, really hard to go backwards. And so we can really, we know it's like to be a geographer already.
I love it. Okay, so let's get into a little bit more about Common Space. Maybe let's start a little bit then. And I think, Bill, maybe let's start with you on this, because I think you already sort of started to touch on this in a bit of the bottlenecks and everything that's there. Before we dive into exactly what Common Space is, let's talk a little bit about what are those challenges and experiences that both of you have had kind of in the last 10 years or so of your careers that sort of led to you having this idea that you needed to create an organization like Common Space with the activities that it's about to undertake. So maybe, Bill, let's throw to you, and you can get as techie as you like here, because I know we've got some good techies on the call. But I'm sure there's probably another podcast to do. I can think Ed Freifogel might be keen to do a follow-up with you on this at some point into the technical aspects of what you guys do. But start with the challenges. What is it this is trying to solve?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just start off by saying access has just been severely limited, right? So a lot of people have great ideas and great even need for the imagery, and they're just unable to get it. I think that really becomes very obvious when there is a natural disaster or a conflict springs up, because these are kind of sudden onset events that people want more information for, and they're unable to get that information. And it, unfortunately, it's a it just keeps happening over and over again. And we're kind of act like we're surprised every time there's a new event that happens and we don't have information for it. So for me, this kind of, it started with the Haiti stuff where, you know, that's where OSM kind of first really came onto the scene, where the original map in Haiti was just like a road, and then satellite imagery became the tool that OSM and then Humanitarian OpenStreetMap ended up used to create that stuff. But the licensing structures, the cost, the downstream use of the data and availability are all issues on top of just the ability to use the data. So you just run into a situation where the data is amazing, but it's not getting to the people that need it. It ends up being largely just held hostage by what I'd say is this higher level of federal government or defense and intelligence users. So it never filters to locals. Yeah.
I'm going to interrupt there and throw to Ree, because I think you use that word need a couple of times. But Ree, I know that you certainly have interfaced with the people very much so, that are the users that want to get access to this. Can you give some characterization to those people? You know, who are these groups of users that are really struggling to get the access that the sort of current system doesn't work for?
Yeah, there are so many stakeholder groups, right? So there's the humanitarian community writ large. There are the human rights advocates. There's the folks that are working in environmental sustainability, climate justice. There are the researchers as well. The science research community also struggles to access this for any of their purposes, especially those that touch on some of the other kind of stakeholder groups. And then journalists are also a really important stakeholder group for us as well, even more so for Common Space these days, as more and more people are using this kind of data. And then, of course, you can't forget the communities themselves. To Bill's point, there are over 1,000 Earth observation satellites observing us every day. But it's not the satellites really that are observing us per se. It's governments, certain governments, and corporations, right, who are largely beholden to those governments, to the defense and intelligence priorities. And so you have this really warped status quo that's beholden to a few powerful interests. And you get folks that are really not benefiting from this, all of those different stakeholders, even despite their best efforts and despite them trying to engage with this system. The transaction costs are really high. As Bill mentioned, and I lived this firsthand when I was at Maxar, trying to navigate the licensing, the pricing, the business models, and the product suites for each and every company that you could go to access high-resolution imagery is incredibly painful. And being on the one side of that table and seeing what folks needed this data for, that they were trying to really do, disaster resilience, that they're trying to help folks who are trapped in conflicts, that they were trying to, build more resilient urban systems, or help folks who are living in informal settlements, not to mention the community mapping and these kind of powerful platforms like OpenStreetMap and Humanitarian OpenStreetMap team, that simply couldn't access what they needed despite having really incredible impacts on the other side that could be realized. And so it was just falling short time and time again, trying to operate within that status quo. And despite our best efforts, and despite even, donors and funders bringing money to the table, it was never good enough to get particularly the licensing, more open licensing that folks needed. Because at the end of the day, these are stakeholder groups that want to be able to share data, because that's how they operate. They have to be able to transparently track what they're doing, because they're accountable not only to communities, but to funders and governments and others, and to be able to publish so that they can share out what's working and what's not working, so we're not all recreating the wheel and spending significant resources on the same thing. So for me, it was born out of this really big frustration of knowing what the potential was and never quite getting there. And so, a lot of people will push back and say, we already have tons of data. Why? There's so much data out there. But the reality is that, having lots of satellites in orbit does not necessarily equate to having access to data here on Earth for all of those constituencies. So that's why Common Space is so greatly needed.
No, I can relate to that one. I mean, as I would say, you know, I've been in this sector for sort of 25, 30 years now, and I think I've heard that frustration of access so many times. So licensing is 100% one of those bugbears. I can't believe we haven't solved it at this point. Like, it's kind of, you know, wild to imagine that we are still talking about this at this stage.
No kidding. Yeah.
But this is a fantastic segue into now getting to what Common Space is. So Reid, do you want to kind of kick us off, and maybe Bill, you can jump in a little bit and add some more flavor to this, but what is Common Space? How's it going to fix this amazing series of problems and challenges?
Yeah, Common Space is a nonprofit, and we are radically democratizing access to high-resolution satellite imagery by building and launching an independent satellite for the community. So we'll be independent of government, independent of venture capital, so we can truly be community governed. We're really trying to flip this power paradigm completely. And have it so that we're prioritizing open data, so that we're prioritizing community governance, so that we can be accountable to actual user end needs, that we can task the satellite to the places that absolutely need the data the most, that are often tasked, but not the data are never accessible, and that we can protect the data with really intentional kind of governance structures to prevent misuse, and which is, you know, obviously a risk when you're talking about conflict zones and disaster zones and things like that too. So the goal for us isn't just about more data. It's really about making satellite imagery a tool for not only just crisis response and recovery, but also averting the next crisis, right? And to have a world in which these kinds of data can actually make a meaningful difference across all of these different areas where we know it can and really has been greatly underutilized. So that's the dream, and we're well on our way with really an incredible community that's rallied behind it so far, mostly through, you know, so far the community demand report that we just published. So if folks haven't seen that yet, I'm biased, but I think it's a fantastic, fantastic read. And there's some really incredible insights there, some that are absolutely not surprising. You know, Denise, as you're saying, like you've heard the licensing over and over again, that was front and center for folks. We absolutely need to have open licenses, but there's a lot of other really great takes in there, and I welcome folks to dig in.
That would be amazing. And that will be, the link to that will be in the show notes. So if you haven't found that, we'll make sure that those links are in there so you can go and find the report. Bill, I'm going to jump in here. I know because Ree and I have got the great fun of trying to design the amazing licensing, governance, et cetera, structure that will be part of how Common Space operates. I know that you, and this will be where many of our user listeners are listening at the moment, are going, okay, but what does that mean? What satellite is this going to be? What's this going to mean? So could maybe give some color to this of what's this satellite going to give people? You know, what are they going to be able to expect? And I guess, how are you building that specification at the moment to be able to get that to happen?
Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting because the needs assessment, I think we also had an idea of what we wanted to build even before the needs assessment. Because again, this is kind of, everyone in the industry has been dealing with these problems for a long time. We generally know the capabilities that we need, but the needs assessment was also a really good place for us to refine that with, you know, 250 users that have actually had this problem. So initially we were kind of looking sub 1 meter imagery. We're still in the sub 1 meter range and really true color. And all this is, again, validated in the report. But we just launched an RFP to the commercial satellite industry. I think it's one of these timing things that gets really, really interesting is, even, you know, a year ago when we were first talking about this, everyone was like, no, like, we can't build a satellite. It's going to be $100 million thing per satellite. It's going to be expensive. It's going to cost, you know, millions and millions of dollars to operate and to build and to launch, and the risks are just too high. And that's where, you know, the market is doing a good job of bringing prices down on both the satellite manufacturing, the launch, and just the overall output that you can get from satellite. So, you know, we're looking at under $10 million for a sub 1 meter visible imagery satellite. And on top of that, there's actually really cool things coming out with communications now, where we can get near real-time optical comms. So that really helps with latency, which, again, came up in the report over and over again, is we need access to on-demand events very, very quickly. And so getting high resolution down to the ground. And again, this is another one of these things that if you're in the industry, you get is something happens and you want to go task a satellite. It's expensive. There's licensing, but it also just takes time because you've got to wait for the satellite to get into position, get the data, downlink the data, process the data. And that can be, you know, in the order of 12 to 24 hours, kind of moving quick. Those timelines are getting drastically decreased, you know, down to minutes in a lot of situations. So when we're looking at the system, we're sending this RFP out to like over 20 different companies that have the capability to actually build a submeter satellite. The hard part is that industry is also fairly new. So there's a lot of different business models. There's a lot of different players out there. People have satellites on orbit that they can sell us already. People can build us a custom thing. So the RFP is fairly vague to say, hey, here's the need that we have for our mission. What special sauce can you bring to this? And then we'll down select with a kind of satellite task force. So again, we have a really good idea of what we want. We can get really cool new technologies that are kind of just coming onto the market right now. But we also want to make sure that the community is involved every step along the way. So and I actually think this is actually going to be easier than the governance task force because we have hardware and costs to talk off each other. But I'm really excited about getting, you know, that system built up, you know, even the agility, right? So, and I think there are a lot of connections between the actual hardware and the governance system, because for example, the agility of the satellite is going to make some determinations on what we are possibly able to task, which could play into governance as well.
100%. I mean, you know, I'm conscious when you're sitting here going, you know, it could be, you know, something that's on the ground within minutes and accessible. It's like, well, then probably we need to make sure that licensing doesn't take you 6 months to sort out whether you can get access to it and use it at that point, because it kind of, you know, negates the benefit at that stage.
Exactly. Got to attack the bottleneck.
That's it. It is. You know, I think that's the thing I often hear these days is it's no longer the technology that's the problem. It's our actual human structures that we've got that are the issue of access these days that are problematic. But I think, you know, it's interesting, Ree, your comments there around, you know, and I'd love to get your take because I know you both come from the kind of, you know, the open data realm and that sort of open principle side here. But, you know, what we're talking about here is not necessarily open in the traditional sense, perhaps, of what we've talked about always with what we're doing, you know. So I think some of that, you know, thinking through the issues of vulnerable communities, vulnerable circumstances that we've got, you know, that potential for harm and building in, how do you, you know, one of the things I always talk about is how do you make sure you get the greatest utility out of the data to the correct users that need it, you know, in that timely fashion, whilst making sure you don't trip yourself up somewhere along there and cause a harm that you didn't mean to.
Yeah.
In the process of doing that. So it's mm-hmm. it's always a really big,
it really
big,
is.
Big challenge there.
Exactly. I mean, that's the tension, right? But I think it's a tension that we have an incredible community of folks who are really, you know, experts and experienced with this to help guide us along this journey, especially as we figure out all the governance mechanisms. And, you know, a lot of what I'll draw on are experiences from when I was at Maxar. I had the privilege of serving on our kind of ethics task force, where we actually got to review different scenarios in which our, you know, there's decision-making structures around whether or not you make imagery available or you sell it to somebody, et cetera. Like we talked about, you know, how do you make imagery available over something like the nuclear reactor disaster in Japan, and what does it mean when a government doesn't want you to make it available, but your core customer is okay with you making it available, and how do you grapple with that when, you know, there could be lives on the line, but also you want to balance that with what's the actual situation. You don't want to scare people, and you don't also want to cause inadvertent harm. And I even saw that when we were working with the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative around the Sentinel Project around the Sudan referendum, of especially what Bill was talking about when you have these, you know, lower latency data flows, which, you know, could potentially put civilians at harm. And so those are all the kind of scenarios that we'll need to consider as we're thinking through who makes the decisions, what is our tasking protocol. But I think, and as well as, you know, what is the kind of access framework for a lot of these, but this is where, you know, and of course I'm biased because we've done this together in the past, but I think there's such great models like what Place has done with their data trust and with having these ethical wrappers that really de-risk and safeguard data from being misused and making sure that data are open because there's a spectrum of open, but it's open with these important guardrails, right, that acknowledge, to your point, there's a great utility here, and we want to maximize that as much as possible while ensuring that we do no harm. And so I think this is where really operationalizing humanitarian principles will be our kind of North Star around so much of this. And these are, again, these kinds of, you know, data protection concerns and even privacy concerns to some degree as we move forward will become more and more mission critical. And we've got a great community to help us along the way.
Amazing. Well, and that's a beautiful point now with mentioning community there, because I think what we should probably tell listeners is, how do they get involved? How do they get involved in the Common Space project? But equally, and I, you know, there's probably twofold. How do I get involved if I'm someone who's really keen to support this? But also, when am I likely to see this data start flowing out? What's the hopes and hopeful timelines of Common Space? Instead of, you know, if I'm a potential user out there, when am I likely to do that? So maybe, I know, Bill, you've already got an RFP out, so I'm going to throw to you first so you can talk about the technical side, and then Ree, you and I can talk a little bit about the governance side.
Great. Yeah. So RFP is out now. We're trying to push forward to get what I'd say is like our actual system spec, which I think will really help with fundraising to say. And we also want to dial in our costs, right? So right now, pretty large error bars on what the satellite will cost, especially as the spec gets finalized. So right now, that's my primary goal is, hey, let's get the spec dialed in and the cost dialed in. Once we do that, I think the next bottleneck is fundraising. But say that was just taken care of, this is also where the timelines are really coming down because of the kind of broader industry base in the space industry. I think we could get this thing built and launched in around 2 years. Which again, from might sound slow for some of the stuff, but for building and launching a satellite, that's incredibly fast. So, you know, what I'd say there is 2.5 to 3 years is the most optimistic timeline. But once that's up there, we can almost immediately start taking advantage of it. That also gives us time to build out partnerships and downstream data analytics that will kind of come online for this. So, you know, having pre-built in population models and building damage assessment models and damage infrastructure models so that when we get our first image, it's kind of having an immediate impact is key to that. But that's kind of, I would say, the technical timeline with most of the error happening sooner rather than later. So once we get this thing funded, it should move pretty quickly.
Amazing. And so I guess that's just a wait and see at this point. You'll start to put out calls at some stage for those partners, or should be people be getting in contact with you kind of now if they've got that great idea or that great case study for you now?
I mean, we're so right now we have this great community support everywhere, yeah, which has been really kept the pressure on us to keep moving and keep moving quickly in a fun way. But I think we need to move that community support to institutional support. So I think that's where we're starting to look at, hey, who are our anchor NGOs that are going to be able to take advantage of this immediately? Who are our anchor analytic partners that will start to build out some of these models? And again, the data under an open license, they would have access to do this. But if we can work on that ahead of time, so, and there's kind of a process as we're building the satellite where we will start to get synthetic data from our satellite that we can start to build against and build out our APIs and our access points and all that technology, right? That's where building up those institutional relationships is going to be really important so that day one that we turn on the sensor, we can start like genuinely helping people immediately.
Amazing. Amazing. Rhiannon, governance. I mean, you know, because that's such an easy task, as Bill points out, like, you know, this would be...
Right. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, in my, again, biased perspective, I think that's where a lot of the innovation is going to happen, right? Like the technology, you know, in terms of what Bill said earlier is there. A lot of it's on orbit to some degree. It can be, you know, built fairly quickly, but having a community governed taskable satellite is an entirely different beast, right? So I'm excited to take that on, and we have currently an open call for folks who are interested in serving on our governance task force, and we'll really be pedal to the metal on that work over the next 6 months, because to Bill's point, we want to have the kind of structures in place so as soon as the data start flowing, we can get it out there and get it to folks. I think one of the other big asks that we have of folks, again, to Bill's point around the institutional support, is please, please write us a letter of support. It's going to help immensely to really evidence all of this incredible community support that we've had so far, but also help us in this next phase as we go to funders and donors and say, this is absolutely, you know, in demand right now, and here's the incredible set of stakeholders that are ready to put the data to good use for all these areas that we're talking about. So that's one of our biggest requests, is letters of support. Please send our way. Join the task force, you know, signal your interest in terms of helping, even on the technical side with Bill. We can use everybody's expertise. And if you have connections to funders and you want to send them our way, please do. We'd love to talk to them and make the case on why we all need this.
No, I would. Well, being part of this task force, I 100% agree with all of that. And I would say to those listening too, you know, thinking about that task force, there's a number of different skills and backgrounds that are really needed in this, you know, trying to solve those bottlenecks that Bill was talking about before. That's a variety of different things. That's understanding those humanitarian principles. That's having people who've been out in the field who understand where those harms have happened that you need to try and avoid, or experience in understanding the geopolitical landscape that helps to inform how decision making happens. But it's also people who may not just always be traditionally geo. So think about your networks. You know, this is also about building a newer style of governance in and model in data organizations here. So people who you know in your field and sphere that are working on how to democratize data or how to better engage with civil society and humanitarian users of data in here are people that are really important to this field. You know, and I love our realm of geospatial. I absolutely adore it. However, we can at times like to sit inside our own group and only call on the people that we know. So I would say it's really important to think a bit outside of the field sometimes and bring some of that thinking in too is super important. Brilliant. Wow. We've reached our kind of, you know, half an hour at this point. So what we are going to do, everybody, is many of these links to things like the demand report, to the calls to get involved in the task force will all appear in the show notes. For this, do jump on the website and have a look. I know both Bill and Rhiannon, they're super friendly people. They will love to have a chat if you have got contributions to make to this. Because I think, you know, whilst it's Bill and Rhiannon at the helm of this, the point of Common Space is actually that it's about meeting a much, much bigger community need. So in order for that to be successful, it needs the support of sort of everybody that's had one of those problems or had one of those challenges or is going to be a user or needs the data that comes out of this is really critical to this. So with that, I'll say, Bill, Rhiannon, fantastic. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today and for sharing all of the goodness and plans that Common Space has. I'm really excited to see where this project goes and what it's going to help bring, I guess, to our geospatial community globally at this point.
Absolutely. Thanks, Denise. And big thanks to the GeoMob audience. Excited to hear from y'all.
Yeah. No worries. No worries. Thanks all. And thanks, listeners. You'll hopefully see this podcast from us in a week or two. But thanks very much. Bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.